generous introduction, and I'd like to start by thanking GSA Tasmania for sponsoring my talk here, paying for my plane ticket over from Australia, which I appreciate. And I'd like to thank the University of Tasmania for, of course, providing the room and the facilities to give this talk. It's a very great pleasure to be here. My parents were 10-pound Poms, and my mother was a whinging Pom. So, although I spent some of my childhood in Victoria, Australia, several years, my family then went back to England. But I personally remember Australia from my childhood with great pleasure, and so I was looking forward very much to coming back here. So, I'm going to start off by explaining what this controversy is. I'm going to talk about the plume hypothesis, and I'm going to explain why my colleagues and I don't favour the plume hypothesis. We don't feel that it stands up to testing. And then I'm going to briefly talk about the plate hypothesis, explain what it means, to try to get across some of these concepts, because I know everybody here will probably have heard of this and be a little bit familiar with it. But I think if we're working in particular sub-disciplines, sometimes we just have a very general overview of what something is, and maybe some of the details are missing. So I'm going to try to aim that everybody in the audience here leaves really fully understanding what the controversy is about and why indeed a controversy exists. So the plume hypothesis started off in 1971. It was proposed by W. Jason Morgan in a letter to Nature, which is only about 1,000 words long. And I really recommend to everybody that you read this paper. Most scientists have never read this. We talk about plumes a lot in our work and our discussions, but people haven't read the original paper. And honestly, it'll only take you 20 minutes. And I teach a third year course at Durham, and the first thing I get my students to do is to read this original paper and think for themselves about its contents. So Jason came up with this bombshell paper in 1971, and he proposed that there are islands, volcanic islands in the world, such as Hawaii and Iceland, and he proposed that these islands, which appeared to experience an excess of volcanism over and above what you would expect, and perhaps in the middle of a plate, that they came from a thermal upwelling which rose from the deep mantle. That's the key thing, from the deep mantle. He said that he thought there were approximately 20 such plumes in Earth, and he produced this map here. And the reason he rooted his thermal upwellings in the deep mantle was because by 1971, it was known, you know, everybody accepted that that continents were drifting and seafloor, you know, was moving, and that therefore the shallow mantle had to be convecting vigorously. And Jason envisaged these plumes to be stationary and the plates to be moving overhead and carrying away linear chains of volcanoes. So in particular, he was led by the time progressive volcanic chain behind Hawaii. So he envisaged these plumes to be stationary. And in order for them to remain stationary, he could not have them sourced in the shallow mantle, because the shallow mantle was convecting vigorously. He had to source them deeper than that. And that's the reason why he proposed they came from the deep mantle. Excuse me. When he produced this figure here, the alarm bells should already have been ringing in people's minds. And I was not an earth scientist at this time, so nothing rang in my mind. But there are individuals here who were probably actively working in geology at that time. And the two alarm bells should have rang because, although he proposed these things just sort of came up from the core mantle boundary, or from the deep mantle, sort of more or less independent of the lithosphere, if you look at them here, of the 16 he plotted, 12 of them are on spreading plate boundaries. So this isn't exactly a random distribution. There's one here, Galapagos, Easter, Bowie. And the other thing is, he said approximately 20, but he only plotted 16 points. So, you know, already this was kind of a little bit, needed a little bit more investigation. So this is what Jason envisaged. This is the core mantle boundary here. The idea is that you get a spontaneous thermal diapir occurring. It upwells and forms this sort of rather thin thing. It nucleates a kind of mushroom head. It impinges on the base of the lithosphere, and then it spreads out laterally. So moving straight on to this plate hypothesis. The plate hypothesis is the exact inverse of the plume hypothesis. The plume hypothesis proposes that this volcanism is driven from the core mantle boundary, and the lithosphere is essentially not involved. It's not controlling things at all. But the plate hypothesis, so this plate comes from, you know, tectonic plates, that's where it comes from. It proposes that the volcanism occurs because the lithosphere goes into extension and pre-existing melt in the mantle passively rises up through the extensional features formed. So the deep mantle is not involved. The issue at hand is not whether or not there's melt in the mantle, because there's melt in various forms and various distributions and quantities throughout the mantle. This is more or less known. But it's just the tearing apart of the lithosphere which is allowing this melt to come through. So it's definitely a top-driven hypothesis. So, moving on to testing these hypotheses, well, of course, the correct scientific way of working is to erect a hypothesis to state what the predictions are and to then go out and test the predictions. But the trouble is, we tend not to do science like that nowadays. The way we tend to do science nowadays is to state a hypothesis, go out and make a bunch of observations. If the observations don't fit, we change our hypothesis a little bit, and then we declare that our hypothesis is confirmed. Or if we send our work to a really sloppy journal, we can claim our hypothesis is proven by the fact that we've got some observations that are compliant with it. But of course, that is not the scientific method. The scientific method is to state a hypothesis, give the predictions, and then try to disprove the hypothesis by testing the predictions. And my colleagues and I feel that the predictions of the plume hypothesis are not fulfilled, that you're going to look at some plume locality and the predictions are not upheld. And this is really the basis for our feeling that the plume hypothesis is not doing the job for us in explaining these volcanic regions. So when we first started really vigorously working on this subject about 15 years ago, it immediately became clear that everybody had got a different understanding of what a plume is. So it's kind of like the blind man and the elephant, that a lot of geologists can be in a room together, they're all talking about the plume hypothesis, and one person thinks this can just be a diapir in the upper mantle, another person thinks it comes from the core mantle boundary, and some people have even told me that any convective motion in the mantle can be a plume. So the first thing we needed to do was to get some sort of definite definition of what these predictions were, and this gentleman here kindly obliged, Ian Campbell from ANU. So, you know, at some point I said to Ian, you know, we can't discuss this subject at all unless you guys who are in favour of the plume hypothesis tell us exactly what you mean and what the predictions of your model are. And Ian is very willing to engage, and he very kindly wrote a couple of papers around about 2007 where he clearly laid out exactly what the predictions are. And he also backed this up by contributing a web page to mantleplumes.org, which is the website we use, explaining this. So this comes from Ian's work. So the plume rises up in this model, it impinges on the base of the lithosphere, and it domes the lithosphere up. So the first thing that is supposed to happen is that the lithosphere domes up by an amount of the order of 1 to 2 kilometres, that this dome is 1 or 2,000 kilometres in diameter, and this should start happening a considerable time, say 10 million years before the next thing happens, which is the eruption of flood basalts. So after this has occurred, you know, these flood basalts should erupt. Numerical modelling has shown that the time period of eruption of the flood basalts should be 10 to 20 million years or so. This is how long it should take to produce them. The third prediction that Ian defined is that there should be a plume tail leading down to the core mantle boundary, and this of course comes from one of Ian's laboratory experiments where he takes a fluid in the lab and produces a little plume from that. So we should be able to image this seismically. The fourth prediction is that there should be a time progressive trail. Morgan said that these things were fixed with the plates moving passively overhead, so we should see a nice regular time progressive trail, as indeed we see behind Hawaii. And the fifth prediction, which falls squarely in Dave Green's remit, is that the source of the melts that erupt should have an unusually high temperature. So then we come to this kind of hotspot thing, and people like to talk about hotspots. A hotspot can, you know, some people say, well, you know, the term hotspot just means an active volcanic area. But I think nobody would call a subduction zone volcano or a regular part of the mid-ocean ridge a hotspot. The term hotspot means that the mantle from which the melt is derived is unusually hot. And we're talking about maybe 200 degrees centigrade, 300 degrees centigrade, hotter than the source of non-hotspot magma, so the source of normal mantle, if you like, which might, for example, give rise to mid-ocean ridge basalts. So we should be able to take rocks from a plume locality, do some experiment or other, it could be many different things, to calculate the temperature from which this melted out of its source, and compare that with basalts from the mid-ocean ridges, and we should see that the, you know, if these indeed are plume magmas, they should give you a temperature of 200 or 300 degrees hotter than the mid-ocean ridge basalt source. So, the predictions of the plate hypothesis, I've squeezed all these into one slide. If we want to explain a volcanic region by the plate hypothesis, there should be some evidence of lithospheric extension. So, this immediately reminds everybody in the audience, I'm quite sure, of what I pointed out on the very first slide, which is of Jason's suggested 16 plume localities, 12 of them were on spreading plate boundaries. So of course these are the most extensional features on Earth. But some of them are not on spreading plate boundaries, and we need to find some evidence if we want to test this hypothesis for the lithosphere being an extension. We see enormously variable amounts of magma at these places. So there are places like Easter Island, which is just a very low volume magmatic region. There are features like the Emperor Seamount Chain, which is the older part of the Emperor Hawaiian system. The volume rate was very low then. But then we see other places where the volume rate is very high, for example in flood basalts or the young Hawaii or Iceland, for example. And what we should be looking for there is evidence of variation in source composition, in particular source fusibility. So if we see a very large amount of magma, we would expect to see evidence of source fusibility, which could, for example, be recycled subducted materials in the source of the basalts. We also predict that the mantle source is relatively shallow. If the lithosphere goes into extension and it's sucking up mantle, melt from the mantle, say, then the smaller the melt volume, the shallower we expect this to come from. So if we do seismic experiments, we don't expect to see tails down to the core mantle boundary. So as I said earlier, my colleagues and I don't favour the plume hypothesis because we feel these five predictions are not met. I would say at this point that we're not denying that the mantle convects. Obviously that would be a crazy thing to suggest. People have sort of said to me, oh, you people don't think the mantle convects. Well, we do think the mantle convects, but what we're actually contesting is this Morgan-type plume, which I've defined for you. So if we look at precursory uplift, again this has a noble Australian history, I'm just going to give a few examples here, because in this lecture I don't have time to do more. So I'll take the example of the Amishan basalts in China. These were erupted in at 260 million years ago. And this has been the site of quite a fun little toing and froing between two Australian gentlemen. In the blue corner here is the cold corner here is Dr. Scott Bryan, who's currently at the Queensland University of Technology, and our friend Ian Campbell in the red corner, the hot corner. And Ian worked with some Chinese colleagues, and they published a couple of papers proposing that domal uplift had occurred prior to the emplacement of the Amishan basalts. And Ian was very excited by these Chinese findings, and he mentioned these in a number of talks, and he also suggested that this was the best possible example, this was the clearest example there was of the domal uplift that he considers important. Scott Bryan, on the other hand, went on to a conference in China, and there was a field trip to the Amishan basalts at this conference, and he and a colleague of his, so he told me, they walked up to the outcrop where the so-called basal conglomerates underneath the Amishan basalts had been identified. So the idea is that if there's uplift prior to a flood basalt, then you should have rapid erosion and you should see conglomerates indicating uplift-related erosion. And so they were taken to these conglomerate localities, and he told me that within 30 seconds they had found marine fossils in these conglomerates and concluded that they were phreatomagmatic deposits and they weren't conglomerates at all. So they were in fact parts of the volcanic succession. And from that, he and his colleague Ingrid Uxton-Pete concluded that this flood basalt had in fact been erupted at sea level, and there was no evidence for precursory uplift of the sort that had been claimed. So there was a kind of toing and froing, and I kept getting all these emails copied to me so I could follow along, and I was quite glad that I wasn't involved, but these two people. So here is where Ian has published, the best documented example of domal uplift occurs in association with the Amishan flood basalt province in China, etc. And Scott, in his paper with Ingrid, has written, in summary, only the Amishan basalts is claimed to show kilometre scale transient domal uplift out of the 77 large igneous provinces known since the Archean. And he then says that this one has gone down the drain as well. So that was very interesting, but one thing I thought was even more interesting was that evidently Scott had looked into all 77 large igneous provinces erupted since the Archean, and he has claimed that not one single one of those shows precursory domal uplift. Now, I haven't looked in tremendous detail into this myself, but I find that very interesting, and if a student is looking for a literature survey paper, then I think that would be quite a good topic to look into. Okay, so the next thing I want to mention is time-progressive volcanic chains. I should say that Ian Campbell has told me that of all the predictions, the one that really he thinks is the most solid and the most the smoking gun for a plume, if you like, is the uplift. He's told me that from his point of view that's the key thing. Well, Jason Morgan has told me that from his point of view the key thing is the time progressive trail. The last paper that Jason produced, and he's now very much in retirement and probably it is his last paper, was one where he basically gave his last word on where he considered mantle plumes were, and the entire paper was on where time-progressive volcanic chains are. So, moving on to that subject, here we have Hawaii. So, the old end of Hawaii is about 80 million years. The so-called Big Bend is 50 million years, and of course there's a large volcanic island there now, which is currently active. time progression is fairly regular. It's not absolutely perfect. So the latest results are that you can get up from 13 centimetres a year down to about 2 centimetres a year. But, you know, to a first order, it's time progressive along the chain. So, of course, the explanation for this in the plume context is that the plume is stationary, the plate is moving overhead, and at 50 million years, the plate changed direction and started moving in a different direction, so you ended up with this bend here. Mm-hmm. And when I was a young faculty member, I used to lecture to my students that we knew that the Pacific plate had changed direction because of this big bend here. The big bend told us the plate had changed direction. So, of course, in my naivety, I was assuming, you know, without question, that the plume hypothesis was correct. Well, people have subsequently done plate reconstructions, so we know how the plates have moved from the directions of transform faults and magnetic reversals and geomagnetic measurements, and people have calculated completely independently of hotspots or anything like that, where the Hawaiian volcanic chain should lie, given these plate motions. And this is the result. So this is where the Hawaiian Emperor volcanic chain should lie, given our knowledge of plate motions from plate closure circuits and things like this. And of course, this is the observation. So there's a huge mismatch here. And what this basically means is that to a first approximation, the locus of volcanism, the point at which magma was erupting, if you like, migrated south underneath a stationary Pacific plate from 80 to 50 million years, and then at 50 million years the Pacific plate started moving and the volcanic locus stayed stable in geomagnetic latitude. So I probably haven't said that very well. By taking geomagnetic cores from all these seamounts and islands, we can tell what was the latitude of the melt extraction locus at the time the seamount was in place. And the latitude migrated, the volcanic locus migrated south while the plate was more or less stationary, almost stationary, not quite, for 30 million years. And then as soon as we get to this point here, 50 million years, the latitude of eruption remained the same while the plate started to move north. So now what does this mean? Nobody has come up really with a satisfactory explanation. The only explanation that's been suggested is that the plume is blowing in the mantle wind, in other words, convection current. Okay. So looking for plume tails. My primary research subject is seismology myself, so seismic imaging is a can of worms. This has become quite sort of talked about recently. I think seismology has gone through many decades where we've all enjoyed a festival of self-congratulation about what a wonderful method it is and how it's the only thing on Earth that can show us the structure of the mantle. But I think we're moving into an era now where we're becoming a little bit more self-critical. And one reason for this, I think I like to kind of cut to the chase and look to the bottom line. If we look at seismology papers, there are many, many very clever people there with many different methods, extremely sophisticated formulations for getting tomography and topography on the transition zone discontinuities and just every seismological thing you can think of. And it can be, if you're not in the particular, you know, today's latest fashion of methodology, then it can be difficult to critique what's going on. But what you can do is to look at repeatability. You can say, well, all of these top people from all these top labs with millions of dollars of funding, do their results agree? So, you know, I had a look at this recently, amongst other things, and we recently published a paper in Terra Nova covering this subject in detail. But this diagram here shows recent identifications of the locality of the proposed Hawaiian plume at the base of the transition zone. So four different studies, we've got four different proposed positions for the plume proposed to be there. And here are a couple of cross sections. So these two are cross sections from different studies running along the volcanic chain. So this is the northwest end and the southeast end from one particular study. This is the northwest end and the southeast end along a different study, and these were published 1 year apart. And one claims to see a plume tilting to the southeast, and the other claims to show a plume tilting to the northwest in a mirror image type style. So what are these guys seeing? I spoke to the lead author of this particular paper, at least the most senior author, and I said, what's going on here? You know, is your result correct or is the other one correct? And he said, neither of these results are resolved. In other words, neither result can be relied upon. So I said, well, why are you publishing this then? This is another study. This is the one that's way, way off. So there was somebody proposed that a plume feeding Hawaii lay there. So this was their result. What they had come up with, they had studied the topography on the 660-kilometre discontinuity, and they'd found evidence that it was somewhat depressed, and they interpreted this as there being a 450 degrees centigrade temperature anomaly at this point here. So David can probably explain to us what kind of petrologies would be expected if the source was 450 degrees centigrade hotter than mid-ocean ridge basalt. Probably be Komatiites, wouldn't it, David?
At least
Komatiites. Anyway, so these workers, from getting seismological results, which they interpreted that way, they concluded that there was a plume stem lying underneath it. And then, of course, the problem was that Hawaii itself was 2,000 kilometres further east from this, so they proposed that some sort of upwelling occurred from the edge of this hot pancake. So why there wasn't a huge circle of Hawaiis all around the edge of the pancake, I don't know. Anyway, interestingly enough, just one week ago, if we're continuing on this theme of repeatability, I received this email from Andreas Fischner, who's an extremely bright, very advanced new faculty member at ETHZ in Switzerland, and he's going to be one of the shining stars of the future. But he emailed me, "Dear Julian, blah blah, using the complete waveforms," okay, this is the latest, sexiest thing there is in seismology today, complete waveform tomography. "Using the complete waveform greatly reduces the vertical smearing that is typical for pure body wave tomography. Interestingly, all the previous detected plumes beneath Europe, Massif Central, Eiffel, disappear." So, you know, the point I want to make is that the repeatability of seismic identification of these plumes is just terrible. And we really do need to go back to the drawing board on this one. Okay, a last point to me, you know, we're kind of getting a little bit slightly more philosophical here, is that we've been studying these proposed plumes for 45 years now. And nobody can agree where they are, how many they are, or what they are, for that matter. I took together some lists here. This is a list from one group of seismologists. This is a list from a second group of seismologists from Berkeley University. Here's another University of California at Berkeley. This is a list from Princeton University, which is where Jason Morgan is. And here is a list which was given to me by a igneous petrologist who said that, in his view, only tholeiitic volcanic provinces were underlain by plumes. And you can see that all these lists are completely different. And if you compare them, in between these four lists, there's only one province which is common in all of these, and that is Hawaii. If you look at any other province, Iceland, for example, doesn't appear here. Let me see, the Boulevard, Triple Junction doesn't appear here, and if you check any other preliminary, Yellowstone doesn't appear here. So, you know, you have to start suspecting that this isn't such a clear matter if after 45 years we can't even agree on the very basic, you know, thing like how many of them can we be sure of and where are these? And furthermore, if you look at these things, this group, for example, this group by Vincent Courtelot. Vincent Courtelot is a French politician, so I suppose his list is a little bit political, but I don't know if he's got the Eiffel plume on. Yes, there's one close to France there. But anyway, what he did, he got together a group of people, and they said, okay, we've got these predictions of the plume hypothesis, so we'll look at all these different provinces, and we'll either say, yes, this prediction is upheld at this province, or no, it isn't. And if it scored a certain number of votes, then it was declared to be a plume, and if it fell below, it's declared not to be a plume. And so it's a very political way of dealing with the plume question. But if you look at his big table of results, then you find that provinces that have got a flood basalt and a time progressive volcanic chain are only three provinces out of the 49 that he talked. So he mentioned. So, you know, this was a piece of work done by somebody who's a plume advocate, and even so, you know, so it's not me biasing the results. If you look at Don Anderson's list of this, you would find zero out of 49 for every one of the predictions. But you know, this is a group of people who favour the plume hypothesis, and they could only find three such provinces which had just got these two predictions upheld in their view. So people deal with these problems not by saying, well, you know, my province here, there were five predictions and there's only one which there's any justification for. Instead of saying, well, the model fails at this province, they just change the model. So they talk about lateral flow. So if you don't see volcanism where you think you should, you say that the plume has propelled this material laterally. If you're somewhere like the Cameroon line, where there's a volcanic chain and the whole thing is erupting just continuously, you know, the entire line, it's not time progressive at all, you say that your plume is tabular. If you see no volcanism for several tens of millions of years when you expect to see it, you say that your plume is pulsing. And it goes on and on and on. So people refuse to let go of the hypothesis. They just alter it in an ad hoc fashion for every single province that they happen to be studying. So this reminds me of geosynclines. It probably doesn't remind a lot of people here about geosynclines, because probably you may never have heard of geosynclines. But a geosyncline was something that was used to explain mountain belts prior to plate tectonics being accepted. And people very quickly found that they needed a different kind of geosyncline for every single mountain belt. So, you know, exactly the same thing happened before the whole thing got dumped when plate tectonics was brought in. So, let's move quickly on to the plate hypothesis. So, the plate hypothesis, as I said before, it proposes that when the lithosphere goes into extension, for example, if you have a rift valley or you have a nascent plate boundary forming, something like this, then melt will leak up from underneath. But of course, the lithosphere can go into an extension in many diverse ways. You can have spreading plate boundaries, you can have back arc spreading, you can have continental rifts and oceanic rifts. So it's not like the plume hypothesis, where the problem with the plume hypothesis really is that it's a simple thing which makes simple predictions, but it's trying to explain volcanic areas which are all different. And if we look here and take a look at some of these, well, Iceland is a massive volcanic island on a spreading plate boundary. Hawaii is a massive plate boundary, not on a spreading plate boundary. Iceland does not have any time progressive trail. Places like Easter Island and these little islands and seamounts here are very tiny provinces with no flood basalts associated with them, etc., etc. And if you look at all of these things, they're all different. So the plume hypothesis is trying to explain all of these things with just one model. But the plate hypothesis is much more diverse, and you know, you can get extension of all kinds of severity and of all sorts. And so it's not surprising that the plate hypothesis fits better a situation where you have many diverse volcanic provinces to explain. I've just got time to give a few examples of what we're talking about here. And the first thing is volcanic margins. So of course, Durham is here, so I'm quite familiar with this area here. I worked in Iceland myself for 7 years and lived there. In fact, I'm an Icelandic citizen as well, so this is my specialty area, if you like. And along the edges of the Atlantic are these volcanic margins, which poured out at the time when the continents split apart about 54 million years ago. So some people explain these volcanic margins, which are basically large igneous provinces, except they erupted on the edge of a splitting continent. And these are commonly explained as plume material pouring out. But the fact is, if you break a continent up, then of course you've got this old cratonic continent, its lithosphere is maybe 100 or 200 kilometers thick. You split the whole thing from top to bottom, move the two sides apart, and of course the asthenosphere from underneath is going to well up through 200 kilometers. So obviously there's going to be decompression melting and a lot of volcanism. And this has been modeled using finite element analysis modeling. And so here we've got the lithosphere splitting apart and the material welling up underneath to fill in the gap. And this modelling has shown that the volumes of melt observed can be produced just simply by this process of upwelling the asthenosphere in between the rifting continents without the need for any temperature anomaly at all. At other provinces, for example, in particular the large igneous provinces of southern Africa have been studied, and there's been a very nice study done of this area, which I'm going to talk about in more detail tomorrow. So I'm just really skipping over a few interesting points in this talk here on these subjects, and I'll be expanding on them and hopefully discussing with the audience how research in these directions could be pushed forward in future. I'll be doing that tomorrow at lunchtime. But in particular, people have studied these large igneous provinces of southern Africa and come to the conclusion that they could not be produced by plumes. In particular, because the lithosphere was so thick at the time they erupted, a plume could not rise shallow enough for there to be a significant amount of decompression melting. So the volumes observed cannot be explained by that. And Silver, the late Paul Silver and his colleagues, so Paul unfortunately died in a car accident and was not able to carry on this work, but they proposed that what is required by the observations in southern Africa is that melt formed over a longer period of time than the eruptions. It formed over maybe several tens of millions of years or even hundreds of millions of years and formed a reservoir at the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary. And then when an orogenic episode occurred, which caused cracking and extension in the lithosphere, that the whole pond drained very quickly. So, as I say, he proposed this because he found it was not possible to explain how these volumes of melt could be produced on the same timescale that they were erupted. He said it was required for the melt to have accumulated over a much longer time period than the actual eruptions that took place. So we have European intraplate volcanism. These are rifts. So this is the Rhine Graben. These are other grabens of various sorts. And the green are volcanics. So this has recently been explained as internal extension and deformation in the European continent due to changes in the rate of convergence at the Alpine boundary. And you can either... David has very generously been telling me about Tasmanian geology, and we've been talking about this, and it seems to me that a continental extension related explanation for volcanism could also fit the Tamar Graben here in Tasmania, maybe other places here in Tasmania. And this is your alternative scenario for explaining these quite trivial volcanic provinces in Europe. This was given to me by an Italian colleague. People have also modelled stress in the plates, so in particular in places which might be difficult to study, like oceanic plates. We really need to know what the stress is. If you have extensional stress in some place, then you might expect more volcanism there than somewhere which is not in extension. And this is a finite element modelling of a ridge transform region here. And the prediction is that you would expect extension on the outer corners of these ridge transform intersections. And there are a number of places in the world that fit that, and one in particular is the Galapagos, which is on the outer edge of this ridge transform intersection here. I'm very interested in the Galapagos, and I'll be talking in more detail about this tomorrow, in particular because it's got some very eerie similarities with Iceland. In particular, there are these propagating rifts here, a lot of papers on that subject here. And Iceland is also a volcanic province which is near several ridge transform intersections, although they're not drawn on this figure here. And obviously the melt, which is now most vigorous at the Galapagos, the melt in this region here has been pouring out of this leaky transform for a long time, and it's built up, my point is not very bright, it's maybe I need to change the battery. It seems to be producing a ridge here of thickened crust here, the Cocos Ridge, and the same at the Carnegie Ridge here, and Iceland appears to be doing something rather similar. There are many other similarities, as I say, which I'll be talking about tomorrow. And the last little example I want to give you is Samoa. So I've tried to pick a few examples from the Pacific, dwelling on the Atlantic. So there are two theories for Samoa. One is, of course, that it's due to a plume from the core mantle boundary. But on the other hand, there's no explanation as to why it's in this particular position here, where it's right on the corner of the Tonga Trench. I have to resort to the pointer. So, of course, the Pacific plate is moving in this direction here, and it's going down a subduction zone just here. But, of course, this plate boundary, it's basically sliding laterally along it. So we have a situation like this here. And Samoa is forming, you know, exactly on this place here. So to my mind, a plume explanation for Samoa is not the hypothesis of least astonishment. We would put it down just to the plate, tear in the plate. So I just want to finish up by saying a few words on mantleplumes.org. I hope some of you may be familiar with this. And I've actually got a version on my laptop that I can show you how it works, hopefully. Here we go. So there's been a lot of effort gone into producing this resource, which is designed to really provide people with information. People who are interested in the plates versus plumes controversy and are interested in perhaps researching into it. So it's not all produced by me. It's kind of produced by me in as much as I manage it, but much of the material on it is produced by individuals who send me summaries of their work. So what I try to do when somebody has produced a paper which is relevant to the debate, sometimes they will send me a summary, and sometimes I will invite a summary, and what we want is summaries which can reach out to interdisciplinary earth scientists. So somebody produces a highly technical paper on petrology or seismology or something like that, it can be very difficult for people who are in other sub-disciplines to understand what the bottom line is. And I kind of think that this is partly what is holding the progress back in this field, because we're all so specialist nowadays. And somebody can look at some petrology or some seismology and say, well, you know, my results don't require a mantle plume explanation, but then there's Bill and Joan and Fred and Anne and Susan here, and they've got geochemistry and uplift and et cetera results, and they're interpreting their results in terms of plume, so their data must require a plume, so maybe I'd better go with this plume model. But the trouble is we're not interdisciplinary enough to be able to fully understand all these other things. So I think this is a big problem in general nowadays. So I get people to give me a summary which is sort of dumbed down, if you like, or you know, at least understandable. I tell them, you know, I have got to be able to understand this, and when we've got something here which I can understand, then I'll post it. And we always have links to the papers and so forth so that people who want to take it to a further technical level can, but everybody should be able to understand these websites. So you click on these links and you get a summary of this person's recent work. And we've recently launched out into making YouTube videos. So I see this hasn't linked up here, but if I click on this, you would go to YouTube and you would see a video of Sebastian Pillay explaining his work. And later in the week, I'm going to take up an interview with David Green, and hopefully there'll be a YouTube video on David's recent work here too. If you're interested in some particular locality, you can click here and you can go down and find something about Hawaii. And a number of people have contributed. What the hell is Hawaii? I think that's my favourite. shall we take a very quick look at this? Situation with hotspots, and the best known, the Hawaiian hotspot, reminds me of a Saturday Night Live skit. To quote Steve Martin, what the hell is that? So, Will is very much kind of riveted by this problem, you know, that the hotspot, if you like, seemed to travel across the plate under its own steam for 30 million years and then stop as soon as the plate started moving. So I think Will would quite like to know why that was. And then there are kind of generic subjects here. If you're interested in thermal aspects, you can click on that, and there are lots of web pages here, including one by Dave Green here. If you want to know about the plume hypothesis, then we have this page that Ian Campbell very kindly contributed. So we post things which are pro-plume or plume skeptic. I don't mind which, as long as they contribute to the debate. As it says on the front page here, finally comes out, the website hosts the debate, and we're happy to. There's quite a lot of other stuff you might be interested in, and in particular here, PowerPoint slide. Many colleagues are very, very generous, and Don Anderson and many colleagues have. Each of these links will give you up to hundreds of PowerPoint slides, which colleagues are very happy for people to use in their own teaching. So if you want to wump together Michele Lustrino from the University of Rome here, he's put his entire Igneous Petrology teaching slides up here. So hopefully these resources will help people. That's the idea. And I think I'm probably more or less out of time. I was going to make one last comment on boxing matches, so I thought this was absolutely hilarious. Thank you so much for producing it, whoever did this. But I suppose I just wanted to say, I don't know why this should be, you've got to turn the power on maybe. Okay. I suppose I just wanted to say that this controversy does get a lot of press, and people sort of talk about, you know, fights and confrontations and all this kind of thing. But to me, this is just a scientific issue. Okay, there are people on different sides, but that's what science is all about. Science is about multiple working hypotheses. And I see no need for there to be any aggressive or confrontational activity associated with this subject. I mean, as soon as emotion and passion and that kind of thing comes into science, I think we start not being objective. So I would much rather that the whole subject was debated, you know, in a atmosphere of mutual respect, with everybody, you know, having the objective of pushing forward our understanding of these situations. And I don't like to see it. I think it's very funny. I'm not criticising this, but I do not personally see this as a sort of confrontational thing with two sides battling against one another, and any more than any other scientific investigation. So with that comment, I'll finish. Thank you for listening.
I'm sure there's no questions at all. Julian, you'd better just sit down.
I think the main is not on here.
Oh, maybe they turned the power off.
There we go. That's the switch. Okay.
So is anybody interested in asking a question? If so, now's the time.
Julian, I'm happy that you've got plates explaining a lot of what we observed for volcanism, but it doesn't explain why. So we need something more than plates, do we?
It doesn't explain what, sorry?
What we see at Hawaii isn't explained by plate theory or...
Hawaii isn't explained by either theory. That's the thing with Hawaii. It's a fascinating thing about Hawaii. There's no satisfactory explanation for it. I mean, there are many other aspects of it I could point out. So, for example, the volcanic rate was trivial right up until about 2 million years ago, and then it just went through the roof. You know, it suddenly shot up by an order of magnitude, maybe two orders of magnitude, I'd have to check. So we see this thundering island here with this large igneous province rate of magma output today, but for most of the time it wasn't like that. So how do you explain that? You know, that's a rhetorical question, not a personal attack. So that's my view of Hawaii, and it's very, very difficult to study. It's almost, I'm not a religious person, but if I was, I would say that God had put Hawaii there as a joke. It's smack in the absolute exact geometric centre of the Pacific plate. It's almost impossible to study seismology, very, very difficult, because all that you put your seismometers out and you want to see if there's a plume underneath it, but all the seismic rays, they're coming from circumpacific earthquake belt, and they're all coming up like a skirt around Hawaii, and there's nothing coming straight up. So, you know, there's so many things, and of course, you know, the ocean is very deep there, the island is quite small, everything is covered with recent lavas, so it's very, very difficult to study. And, you know, Hawaii's got, there's no evidence for precursory uplift because there's no large igneous province at the far end. The track is time progressive, but it's not time progressive in a way which is consistent with a stationary plume. David could comment on the evidence for high temperature petrologies. Some petrologists claim that they see this in Pickwright glasses. David's position is that the temperatures calculated for those glasses are the same as that you get at mid-ocean ridges. And as I say, we can't see a tail down of the core mantle boundary, mostly because it's impossible at the current time to do the required experiments. So what we really need is some bright grad students out there to come up with a really good way of doing a new experiment there, throw more light on this.
So you have to have a third option, at least.
No, I don't think you have to have a third option. The plate hypothesis has not been tested there. I mean, nobody has devised a way of looking to see if the plate is an extension. Tomorrow at lunchtime, I'll be showing you some finite element observed to be much higher than that, indicating that the proportion of helium-3 to helium-4 is much higher. And of course, as you say, helium-3 is a primordial isotope, whereas helium-4 is produced by potassium and uranium decay in the Earth. So we have the young Earth, which is formed, and it's got helium-3 in it, and the helium-3-helium-4 ratio is about 200 to begin with. And as time goes on, helium is continually lost to space, and more helium-4 is produced. So this ratio reduces as a function of time. So if you find somewhere where the isotope ratio is 50, say, then what you're looking at is an old signal. You're looking at the signal that you've preserved somehow the helium isotope ratio from further back in time. You're not looking at something deep, you're looking at something old. So the question is, where can you store this old material? So this argument that you're describing, people found these high helium isotope ratios and they said, oh, this is old, so it must come from unprocessed primordial material, and we know the upper mantle is convecting vigorously, and so this must have been stored somewhere else. Let's put it at the core mantle boundary. But we know for a fact that there's a great deal of old material at shallow levels in the Earth. So this old helium signature does not have to come from deep. There's several web pages on this subject on the website. Yeah, there's some other planet web pages on the website also.
Mars, just for an example, that's massive.
Yeah, people are particularly.
But it doesn't have much electronic support.
No, exactly, yeah. So Mars and Venus are the two places that people are most interested in, and of course, they talk about Tharsis Mons. The latest point of interest on that is that people are now saying that Shatsky Rise is a bigger volcano than Tharsis Mons, so that's quite an interesting factoid, but geological trivial information. But people discuss whether Tharsis Mons is due to a huge plume inside Mars, and Venus, of course, is covered with circular structures, and there's a debate there about whether these are caused by plumes rising internally within Venus or whether they are, in fact, impact structures. And people have also modelled an impact model for Tharsis Mons to see if that can explain the volcanism there. So the debate is out there, and I suppose I would say that if we can't even decide whether there's a plume under Hawaii or not, then it's even more difficult to try and argue about Venus and Mars. Even less information.
I've got one question on why are there distinct melt types, the ocean island basalts being very, very well known. Is that something that just needs to be explained by either hypothesis? Can the plate hypothesis account for the distinct composition of ocean island basalts?
Well, you've played into my hands, thank you very much. The geochemical signature in ocean island basalts is the signature of inclusion of a certain amount of shallow recycled materials in the melt source. So this is where the fusibility, this is exactly what we would expect if we were looking for ocean island basalts to come from a more fusible source than mid-ocean ridge basalts. So if you have a source material that's got some amount of recycled oceanic crust or lithosphere, something like this, then this is going to make the source more fusible, so if you tap melt from that region, then you get a larger volume. And in fact, Alex Sobolev at University of Moscow, he's actually done some studies of this recently, which no doubt I think David probably disagrees with, but it's interesting just the same, that Alex is predicting 10 or 20 or even 30% of recycled materials in Hawaiian and Icelandic basalts.
So just to clarify, that term fusible means more refractory?
It means it's got a lower melting point.
Lower melting point.
Yeah, so the solidus is at a lower temperature. So
right.
So if you given the same temperature, you have more melt from this material.
Okay. Less refractory.
Yes.
Just continuing that point about the difference in chemistry and petrology, because
optical layer which has got low velocities, and this might be, say, to a first approximation, 100 kilometers depth. So the brittle solid plate might be approximately 100 kilometers thick, and you yourself and other petrologists such as Dean Presnell have made estimates on where the solidus suddenly reduces in temperature because of the presence of CO2 or water. And I think these are the best ways to go about finding that out. You go down in the lithosphere down to a certain level, and then you reach a point where there must be partial melt. And this is shown not only by geochemical modelling, such as petrological modelling, such as your own and Presnell's, but also by seismological observations that show that there's a sudden drop in shear wave velocity at that point. So it's all fairly self-consistent.
Controversial whether plume, which is widely used, but as you said, used in very different ways. It's time we really did tackle that, not as a matter of authority and faith, but as a matter to be tested, and really the predictions, as you said, tested properly. So thank you for this talk tonight. We look forward to tomorrow, an opportunity for a smaller group to ask questions and seek further ideas. As you talked, you gave a lot of reference, or significant reference, to the experimental work that I've been part of for many years. That was mostly done here, and the people that did it were Trevor Falloon, most importantly, and Linton Jaggers before that. So that work, the testing of the high temperature for mid-ocean ridge and Hawaiian-type magmas, that was done in this department when we had a high-pressure laboratory, and Trevor Falloon and Linton Jaggers, the principal workers that established that extremely important database that needs to be applied to the question. And the future certainly needs to do more sampling of the ocean floor and to look for the evidence directly in magmas themselves of their temperatures of quenching, temperatures of eruption, both from the mineralogy and the composition of glasses. So there's a real future in that investigation, that line of study, and thank you for summarising the controversy for us, and we look forward to tomorrow for further questions and where the subject goes next. Thanks, Celia. Oh, and I have